Welcome. In this third episode of Imagining Turkey series, we are hosting Ayşe Zarakol. Ayşe Hocam, welcome.
Happy to be here.
I'd like to start with actually your contribution. As a group, we have read your amazing book, Before the West, and your entire scholarship, but especially your latest book, Before the West, is written as an intervention to both international relations theories and to the way somewhat both media and lay people imagine the world in the way we have seen it. So shall we start with maybe talking about this? What is the intervention you are offering as a maybe simple introduction to today's conversation?
Sure. My goal was to provide an alternative history that people could think with, especially international relations scholars, but in general, social scientists. Because, you know, for decades, we've been criticizing social sciences for being Eurocentric. And these criticisms are well made and in general, I think, well received. So our various fields are full of, I mean, not necessarily everybody is convinced, but there are many people who are looking for alternative ways to think about the world. But we don't have those alternative accounts yet. And the book came out of my own dissatisfaction with just criticizing. I thought I need to offer an alternative. As we say in Turkish, you know, putting your hand under under the rock. So that's where the project came from. So what's the next step after we've criticized existing accounts for being Eurocentric? So in the book, I'm trying to offer a history of international relations that doesn't start in Europe, that doesn't start in the West. It starts somewhere else, in this particular case, Asia, Eurasia, and then tries to develop a narrative, a connected narrative of Asia, Eurasia, that doesn't privilege any one actor or any one corner of the space, and then connects also with the European narrative, of course. So that's what I'm trying to do.
It's not in my questions, but this conversation is taking me to another level right now. Right at the beginning of your introduction, you kind of try to develop a narrative that decentralizes, but also does not necessarily any particular part of the world. So in my observation, people want to centralize themselves to understand others. So how do you kind of navigate through this? How do you gain intelligibility when you are kind of decentralizing every possible potentially nationalist narrative?
It's difficult, so you have to be quite reflexive about it, which is why in the book I also have an epilogue where I consider my own positionality. Am I doing this? Am I talking about Eurasia? Am I talking about especially the Turco-Mongol narrative because I'm from Turkey? So you have to be, I think, quite aware that we all have this tendency, of course, because, you know, what's familiar is more accessible or relatable, as you say. I think the solution is to keep the account, whatever account we're developing, as relational. So rejecting this identity of imagining countries or nations or even religions as trans-historical, because it's never one thing. You know, things change over time as they're exposed to other things. And then not provincialize the narrative, and also not get like too seduced by present-day identity divisions and try to imagine maybe the world as it would have been experienced by the people of the time period you're writing about. But it's difficult, I agree.
Thank you. It's really exciting, actually. I was also thinking how not many scholars have actually been offering those alternative readings while it became kind of like almost, as you said, an accepted fact that we are critical. Yes, Eurocentric is problematic. It reminded me of an anthropological conversation I've been developing in a number of occasions when it comes to decolonizing anthropology. Yes, we understand anthropology is a Eurocentric project, has started as a very European colonial project and has taken a different direction from there. But then how are we going to offer some materials for the students so that they can go beyond the Eurocentric theories? And there's an amazing scholar, I really look up to him, Hasan Haj. And he kind of talks about how certain critiques are enabling, certain others are disabling, and how do we find the right tone? And I do find your scholarship very enabling. So I hope like today's conversation will kind of lead to that angle.
in response to what you said, I mean, the important thing is not to replace one ism with another ism. Like, so we don't want to get Eurocentricism and put some other provincial ism in its place. Mm. We just have to be aware of that danger.
And you do, I remember reading very reflexive parts in your book on, you know, Neo-Ottomanism, but also Sinism.
Privileging Eurocentric Chinese accounts or modern day like nationalist Chinese accounts. Like, so we just have to be aware of, you know, where fighting Eurocentricism can sometimes take us in terms of present day political projects.
You explain the rise and fall of multiple world orders from the 13th century to 18th century. And I'd like to ask what the world order is. In basic sense, can you elaborate on your particular intervention to the term in the international relations literature?
Thank you. I get this question a lot. I define world order as the man-made rules, understandings, and institutions that govern and pattern relations between the actors of world politics. But what I'm really saying, like in lay terms, is, you know, essentially what we call international order now. And I distinguish this from structure. So things beyond our control, they're not order. But things that, you know, institutions, rules, norms, these things that we create deliberately, I mean, even if they don't function in the ways that we create or intend, this is the order part. And we call this now international order, but I didn't want to use the word international because what I'm writing about is a time before nations and nation states, really. So what I'm talking about in the book are orders of houses. I call them great houses. And so I call them world orders to create a commensurability. So we can compare our international order with these other orders, inter-house orders. And the word that captures both is world order. Orders with world-covering ambitions is what I'm getting at.
So when we were reading your book, we saw that you were like using this concept of ontology and ontological fabric quite a lot. We are actually really interested in delving into this a little bit, both like in broader terms and particularly in relation to Turkey. So first of all, how do you locate the term ontology in international relations to understand the global relations? And how does it help us understand the shared histories, interconnectedness, and cultural exchanges across geographies that are actually deemed really isolated and completely unrelated in our national imaginations? And maybe we can tie this to how this concept helps us understand Turkey's positionality in international relations.
Thank you. I mean, I suppose I use the word ontology in different ways, in different works, but if I had to summarize, like, why do I use that word as opposed to some other world? So referring to what the world is made of, right? What people think is the world is made of. And you can call that philosophy, habitus, like religion. I mean, we have different terms for how people understand and imagine the world. And I'm trying to find a word, I suppose, that captures all of that. So, I mean, in the specific example of Turkey, you know, it's not enough to say, you know, it's Islam. It's not enough to say, like, Persianate ecumene. It's not enough to say, like, Byzantine influences, right? So it's capturing all sorts of things that come together in unexpected and hybrid ways that kind of shape how people that live in that geography kind of look at and understand the world, I suppose, would be what I'm getting at. So that's where I would start, I think. And of course, I mean, we have specific uses for the term in international relations. So we have the concept of ontological security, which refers to, you know, while it came out of international relations for much of 20th century, was very focused on physical security, that arguing that countries cared about their physical security, territorial integrity, and then came along people who wanted to say, well, it's not, security is not just about that. It's about also who you are, like ontology, like how you know yourself, how you know the world. So certain dynamics that are physically very threatening could be ontologically secure because that's all you know. Like, so if you're like in an abusive relationship, let's say in a domestic household with like your husband, you may be physically threatened, but because that's all you know, that may be like you still cannot leave that situation because you're getting some ontological security from it. There's a predictability to it. Similarly, countries may be in conflict dyads. They could be physically threatening each other with like invasion, but that the conflict may be ontologically secure because, again, they define themselves in relation to this enemy that then, you know, helps them make sense of their identity and why they exist. So that's another specific use of the term in international relations. And I've written about ontological security in relation to, for instance, you know, state crimes, historical crimes. Like, why do some states have difficulty apologizing for past crimes? It doesn't matter that much because it threatens them ontologically. It contradicts how they imagine themselves in the world, their place in the world. So that sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to talk more about it, but that's, you know, these are some of the uses of that concept.
I think I will follow this a little bit further then, because I'm really interested also in the particular way you locate Turkey in this interconnected global world and Turkey's ontological realities. And in different work, you refer to Turkey as ambivalent, and in another work, I think twice in both of your books, you refer to Turkey also as like liminal. Shall we discuss this a little bit further with you?
Sure. I mean, so what creates ontological insecurity is not, again, fixed in time. So it depends on how categories are organized. And in modernity, you know, especially with 19th century onwards, what we have is an international order with the West at its center, its core. And if you're like in that core, if you find yourself in that core, you tend to be ontologically more secure. Like, your place in the world is both higher status and also more like clear, like how what your place in the world is. I mean, that doesn't mean everybody, like every country that the general person would consider Western is ontological. I mean, in some ways, like nobody can fully achieve perfect ontological security. You could still be in the core and have issues. So you never get it. But comparatively speaking, they have it perhaps a little bit easier. And then everybody else outside of that core is ontologically more insecure, partly because of like status hierarchies, but also because the other categories, I would say, don't have clear labels. So we have the concept West, but then we say non-West. You know, it's like always not that. You're like not European, right? So like Asia or East or Global South, like these categories are not as, they don't seem to be as immediately available or like their substance or like their what's in it is not as obvious. They don't seem to be as endogenously driven. I mean, not that any of these categories are endogenously generated, but West creates that illusion that it is. So if you're not West, then you're already like, your identity is already fuzzier and a bit more uncertain. And then if you happen to fall extra in the middle of West and not West, like if it is possible that you could go either way, then that creates even more ontological insecurity. So for these reasons, you know, one could say, I think Turkey perhaps has more ontological insecurity than others whose identities seem to be more, like better, more easily defined.
It's because of this liminality then.
Yeah, well, but it's not just that, but it adds to it. You know, there are all these other sources as well. I mean, part of the reason why I wrote the book Before the West is, I mean, even though the categories are problematic, like when you use the terms West, East, I mean, already you're like reproducing some of these problematic categories. But at the same time, I thought, wouldn't it be, you know, maybe better if the category East had its own history and it wasn't just not West, or it wasn't just like part of this amorphous like global South, like the East, quote unquote, has its own history, has its own shared special dynamics. So like trying to kind of prop up that label, that category, and then maybe people or countries more easily associate with it, because then it's not such a source of insecurity, then because it seems to have some shared, maybe positive, even not entirely positive, obviously, but something substantive, maybe, as opposed to just a negation of not West.
No, it's definitely substantive, because it's kind of like, although as an anthropologist, I've never heard the term or concept ontology to be used to understand nations, like international relations, sometimes such a foreign field to us, right? Like when I'm reading your work, it always makes sense to me. Also, like it kind of helps me to think about how these kind of new types of connectivities offered by new globalization processes are actually inherently threatening those ontological realities of different nation states as well. It's kind of, and it explains all these kind of the new political anxieties leading to new types of populisms. At least that's kind of like, that's not the topic of your book at all, but it does give me the substance. That's what I mean by substantive. It does give me some tools to think further on my own area.
Yeah, while we were discussing these like these problematic yet there categories of like the East and the West, I wanted to again ask a question about Turkey, which has like these competing modernist, let's say, political projects currently that associate Turkey either with Europe or the West in general, or Asia, the East, or the Middle East. Yet, as in this work and in your other work, you talk about Turkey's ontological insecurity as a state that's coming from being neither Europe nor Asia. And Turkey's this geographical, historical, political position create this ambivalent self. So what do you think it will mean to see Turkey's heritage, or let's say ontology, as both European and Asian, or like a synthesis or a blend of that? Contrary to nationalist or Islamist political imaginations, can we suggest an alternative ontology for Turkey? That would, maybe it's neither or either of them. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's how I try to think about it. So, I mean, the tendency in Turkey is either to over-identify with the West and kind of like erase anything that's like gets in the way of that. You know, there's been a lot of experimentation with that, especially in the 20th century, which I've written about in my first book, After Defeat. Or as a reaction to that, you know, kind of idealize like what's not Western, or, you know, thinking like this, you know, what's not Western, you know, maybe what's really associated with Islam, or like this is the authentic part of Turkey, or like, you know. But in my ideal world, countries find security, ontological security, kind of like people, you know, we kind of have to accept everything that has led us to this moment, you know, the many different sources of our identity without judgment, you know, in some ways, because like the combination of it is what makes one unique and interesting and a specific actor in the world. So in the book, when I'm arguing in Before the West, when I'm arguing that the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century didn't care so much about Europe, it was much more oriented towards this competition in that's coming out of Asia, like the older Chinggisid sovereignty models, etc. It's not to say like Europe doesn't matter or Islam doesn't matter. It's just, here's another vein that's been overlooked, and I'm emphasizing it because it's been overlooked. Like, if we could just accept all these myriads of influences, because they're all part of the story. Again, you know, when I say without judgment, I don't mean to say we cannot have personal preferences as to which of these veins is more preferable, etc. But it's history, right? It's all, like, whether we like it or not, it's contributed. So we kind of have to embrace, or accept at least, that these are you know, parts of the identity of this geography. And then once you accept it, kind of as you, as an individual, if you accept the things that make you who you are, then you're not apologizing for it, or you're not trying to compensate for it. And that's, you know, as close as I think as we can get to ontological security, if we cannot fully achieve it.
Yeah, since we've touched upon this, I don't know, the East and associating with the East and associating with Islam, or just like focusing on one way in that made you, let's say. So one of the interventions you offer is to lessen the effect of Islam in like analyzing these geographies or these empires. But in my reading of your work, you discuss three post-Timurid houses and their universalist claims of sovereignty. In the Eurocentric perspective, like there's this idea that Islam is the common ground and determinant of the political actions and claims of these empires. But you argue that Islam is rather secondary, if it's not like irrelevant, in comparison to their shared sovereignty model. Can you elaborate on this, both through historicity and your critical intervention to the hegemonic understanding of Islam as the sole determinant of political authority in these geographies, in these empires?
Yes, the book downplays the importance of, not so much the importance, but I don't talk about Islam as much as would be expected. When we generally talk about the Ottoman, Safavid and the Mughal empires, the traditional way is to refer to them as Islamicate empires or sometimes gunpowder empires. But what I'm doing in the book instead is to tell a story where I'm saying the way that they were acting, chasing universal sovereignty, the source of this is actually the most direct influence that's causing this is the Timurid, and before that, the Chinggisid model. You know, that's where it's coming from. And I think I will stand by that. It's not that these Islam did not play an important role in these empires, especially in the general practices of the subjects and so on. But the model that I'm delineating in the book, the Chinggisid model, the sovereignty model, that's so centralized around, you know, the person of the ruler, where the ruler has essentially unlimited power, including lawmaking power. That's actually a very old model that we find much more in antiquity. These, you know, godlike rulers, emperors. And then that kind of goes away. And I would say one of the reasons it goes away is Islam, but also similar religions of the book, because they act as a check on this type of power, like an earthly person having that much power is actually, you know, not allowed in religion, because power is in the other world, right? It's with Allah, it's with God. A person cannot act as a god, a truly like devout person. So Islam is always a check on this type of limitless empire, one person having so much power. So without the Mongol or Timurid infusion into Islamic geographies, I don't think this model would have made such a strong comeback. It's the hybridization of these two things that produced these empires. And as a result, you know, in the 16th century, you have nominally Muslim sultans that are actually putting themselves above everything, above Sharia, above, you know, making laws. And that's a bit problematic. And then later is checked, like this power is again checked by the ulama and so on. But there is a moment where, you know, they're acting in ways that are in contravention, I think, of, you know, the earlier Islamic model. So that's what I'm saying. That doesn't mean, you know, again, it's Islam is not a big part of the story, but I'm kind of pointing to an overlooked angle. I mean, it's not always overlooked. It's not like others haven't noticed that before me, but kind of, you know, again, underlining something that doesn't often come up in these discussions, more simplistic discussions of secularism versus Islam. Like we've lost, you know, kind of we've flattened all these different sovereignty arrangements into like a binary, but there are actually many different influences and sources.
You've been exploring the concept of sovereignty and linking the conversation on Turkey to your approach. How does sovereignty evolve in the context of world order for the Ottomans? Where are the Ottomans in this new model you offer?
In general, there's this idea that sovereignty was invented by by Europeans, that it doesn't really like predate, the concept doesn't really predate 16th, 17th century European politics. All of my research agenda is against this, because I think, of course, I mean, the word, like the particular word, like the term has its own history in, like, you know, European languages. But it captures, you know, this authority, like ruling arrangement. I think that's one of the most fundamental dynamics of, you know, political order. And I don't think it's anybody's invention. I mean, that doesn't mean there's always sovereignty. Like there are arrangements also without, you know, a sovereign. You'll know, like David Sneath, who's an anthropologist, who's at also Cambridge, whose work I use in this book. You know, he's written about headless state and so on. So I'm not saying everything is sovereignty, but what I am saying is we shouldn't reserve the term for nation states, which is a particular sovereignty arrangement with a particular history attached to, you know, modernity. We need a broader understanding of what sovereignty is. So I associate it with centralization of authority. And if you define it that way, then you find many different sovereignty packages in many different geographies. In the book, I'm looking at one particular model that I say was very influential, I mean, in Eurasia especially, but also globally, from 13th to the 17th century, so much so that I think one could argue even the European model in some way is triggered by its influence. And the way the Ottomans figure into that story is, I mean, they partly have this heritage themselves. I think the Haas of Osman, because they also have roots in that geography. But then it's kind of brought back, like reanimated with the influence, especially of like Timur and that competition. After that point, 15th, 16th century, what we see in the case of Ottomans is an experiment with sovereignty, which, as I say, is again very much located in the person of the ruler. You know, most obvious example being later in the 16th century, Kanuni, like he's called the lawgiver. Like when you're reading about that in primary school, like it seems like, of course, he's the lawgiver. Why wouldn't he be the lawgiver? But within the Islamic context, it's actually odd for the Sultan to be the lawgiver. He shouldn't be making laws at all, right? So it's that influence, that particular sovereignty model, again, hybridized with Islam, is what we find in early modern era Ottoman Empire.
Thank you. There's a lot to talk about. Your book has received 5 awards across different areas of social sciences, and its academic impact is quite high. And we were talking about, when we were discussing your book with colleagues and with friends, Zeeshan and Hazal here, that it is a very approachable book also in terms of its language. So it is addressing lay people, somewhat educated lay people. It is designed to be approachable. So I feel like you want to leave a mark. I think my wrap-up question is, would you like to share the positive impact you have envisioned while authoring this book?
Thank you. That's very nice to hear. I thought about writing it as a trade book for a more like completely general audience, but then it was too difficult to do so. So it ended up being an academic book that's hopefully written in an accessible way, because I think I still had too many academic fights to fight in my head.
I really personally find it very important, because now we still think being accessible is just making things open access. But if nobody can read it or nobody can understand, but I did see your book when I was in Cambridge. It's part of this on the window, right? Books of the year. And it was there. It was like presented to the public as those, you know, liked and enjoyed by the editors. So it has another accessibility. So yeah, that's why I'm very interested in what you want to accomplish. I really want to hear your vision in that.
Yeah, I mean, that's very important to me. That's always important, especially with books. I mean, less so in articles, but I always try to write in a way that will maximize the readership. So in this book, I thought, okay, if I can't write a trade book for a general audience, because I'm still attached to my like terms like sovereignty and my footnotes and so on, at least maybe I can write in a way that other academics who are not international relations scholars can read it and enjoy it. Because, I mean, we all have this issue, but international relations is a particularly bad case of it, because we have like very esoteric debates that nobody else even sees the point of. So that's, you know, trying to avoid that as much as possible. But yeah, I mean, what I was trying to do is to create this connected history. And then once you put it out there, then others can, you know, read into it what they want to. And of course, I'm relying so much on the works of historians, historical sociologists, or historical anthropologists. But my advantage is, whereas all of those disciplines, I mean, with the maybe exception of historical sociology, like really emphasize specializing in a particular time period and place, in international relations, we can kind of move around. So I thought what I could offer people is an account that takes the bird's eye view and connects things that are not time periods and places that are not traditionally connected. But at the same time, of course, I want to be sensitive to location as well. I don't want to completely lose sight of that. So I thought that's what I could offer, you know, this synthesis. That was my goal.
Thank you very much. We have enjoyed this tremendously. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for being an important pillar in the makings of Imagining Turkey series.
We appreciate that. We enjoy the process of reading your book and discussing it and like having this virtual conversation here with you. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I will just repeat what my colleague said, but thank you. I really appreciate that you made us like an international relations book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.